Hi, welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Justine Toe.
I'm Simon Smart.
Well, we're coming up to a really important date in history for those of us who are real history buffs. Did you know that this year, on the 22nd of November, marks the 50th anniversary of the death by assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the 35th President of the United States? He was famously shot in Dallas as he and his wife Jackie were riding in an open-top car. And I'm sure you've seen this particular image. It's one of the most definitive ones of the 20th century. People have even said it's like a flashbulb memory. You know, you know where you were when you heard about the news for the first time. And other events like, you know, the death of Diana and maybe the shot of the Twin Towers as they were impacted by those planes are also flashbulb memories. So the kind of death of Kennedy is in that category. But less people know that another very famous man also died on the same day. This was C.S. Lewis, the great atheist turned Christian apologist who also wrote the Narnia fantasy series. He died on the same day. So, this November, as the world remembers that day in Dallas in 1963, we also recall the life of C.S. Lewis. So today on Life and Faith, we're going to think about the legacy of these two men.
In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man.
That's from the inauguration speech of JFK in 1961, and thank you also to the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum for help in getting us that clip. Now, Simon, it's quite something to think of both Kennedy and Lewis, you know, really big figures of the 20th century, dying on the same day.
It's a really funny, strange coincidence, isn't it? I've worked out that it was probably about an hour before Kennedy was shot that Lewis slumped to the floor of his bedroom and died. So, yeah, you know, losing those two great figures on the one day is an interesting aspect to this story. Of course, there was so much media attention on Kennedy's death, as you'd understand, and even though C.S. Lewis was quite a famous man himself, even many of his friends didn't hear about his death and therefore didn't make it in time for the funeral because all the media attention, the newspapers were flooded with this stuff on Kennedy's death.
It's pretty incredible. How about we think about the legacy of each of those men? We'll start with Kennedy. You know, how's he remembered? I think he seems a bit like Obama, I guess, does today, you know, if he's like a young, funky president, basically.
Yeah, Kennedy was the youngest president elected up to that point, and he had that real charm, that real Hollywood kind of vibe about him and his wife, Jackie. They were sort of like the great love story, if you like, in people's minds at least. And this image of them has been frozen in time, so they have this sort of eternal youth and idealism attached to them. Kennedy was known for his soaring rhetoric, great speeches, you know, the hope of a new generation. They're fighting communism. It's kind of the free world. And he sort of stood for a lot of the things that were good about that. There's things like the Peace Corps, which was a really idealistic vision of sending out young Americans into third world countries to work, and that still goes on today. He was thought of as a statesman, averting disaster in the Cuban Missile Crisis, when he really had to stare down the Soviets right at the point where it looked like things could go terribly wrong. He was the one who announced the audacious plan to get people to the moon, get a man to the moon. There's those sorts of things. He was known for those who loved him, anyway, as someone of compassion, interest in poverty relief and issues of civil rights and that sort of thing. There's a kind of a myth that's developed around him as this great hope for the nation.
We've actually got a clip of President Kennedy's address to the nation in the wake of attempts to desegregate the University of Alabama on the campus. And so he's responding to threats of violence and unrest, and that informs the background of this speech.
This nation was founded by men of many nations and backgrounds. It was founded on the principle that all men are created equal, and that the rights of every man are diminished when the rights of one man are threatened. Today we are committed to a worldwide struggle to promote and protect the rights of all who wish to be free. And when Americans are sent to Vietnam or West Berlin, we do not ask for whites only. It ought to be possible, therefore, for American students of any color to attend any public institution they select without having to be backed up by troops.
Now, this period of Kennedy's reign, Simon, it came to be known as America's Camelot, right? Like the beloved king and his family, and represented a real golden age, I suppose, in American history. But it didn't really last, did it? You've told me that as the years have gone by, there's been story after story that's sort of exposing the lie behind, you know, the myth.
This story still inspires people. Some of what Kennedy stood for remains as a source of pride for Americans, and that sense of sadness that it didn't continue. But I guess there's been massive interest in his story, and as people have dug into it, it's been revealed in many ways, at least, to be aspects of his life to have been a bit of a fairy tale without much substance. Christopher Hitchens, who's not known to hold back in his criticism of people, says that the whole Kennedy myth was built on sex, showbiz, money, and bravado. He was presented as the great, vibrant, energetic young president, but we now know that he was terribly unwell. He was racked with all sorts of physical problems, awful back pain, which was crippling, and he had to take a lot of drugs to deal with that. He had Addison's disease, which is a degenerative, degenerative disease of the adrenal glands, and it's fatal. He had all sorts of stomach problems, and he was propped up by a cocktail of drugs. And sometimes in these really key moments, like the Cuban Missile Crisis, like his terrible meeting with Khrushchev in Vienna, he was sort of supported by a pharmaceutical cocktail. And really, it seems to kind of count against that image of him being so vibrant. But when it comes to the kind of marriage, I guess, the great love story of him and Jackie, that's when things are really shown to be not as they appeared. This great glamour couple that you see sort of frozen in time in these great Time Life photographs, really, it was a pretty sad relationship. At the very least, if even a tenth of the stories of Kennedy's indiscretions were true, it really is quite an astonishing life of sort of sexual conquest after conquest, heaps of mistresses and so on. It's a real dark side of that Camelot idea. And you know, without going into the details of that, one biographer said he compared it to Caligula, the Roman emperor. You know, it's more Caligula than Romeo, put it that way. And so it's certainly a tarnished image.
Wow, you're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. We're talking about John F. Kennedy and C.S. Lewis, who died on the same day, 50 years ago this week. Well, that's Kennedy. How about we turn to C.S. Lewis? He's also known as Jack. Here's a reading from The Last Battle.
It is as hard to explain how this sunlit land was different from the old Narnia as it would be to tell you how the fruits of that country taste. Perhaps you will get some idea of it if you think like this. You may have been in a room in which there was a window that looked out on a lovely bay of the sea, or a green valley that wound away among mountains. And in the wall of that room opposite to the window, there may have been a looking glass. And as you turned away from the window, you suddenly caught sight of that sea or that valley all over again in the looking glass. And the sea in the mirror, or the valley in the mirror, were in one sense just the same as the real ones. Yet at the same time, they were somehow different, deeper, more wonderful, more like places in a story. In a story you have never heard, but very much want to know. The difference between the old Narnia and the new Narnia was like that. The new one was a deeper country. Every rock and flower and blade of grass looked as if it meant more. I can't describe it any better than that. If ever you get there, you will know what I mean.
Well, that was C.S. Lewis's The Last Battle, read by Grace Now. Now, Simon, he was a convert to Christianity, wasn't he, after being an atheist?
Yeah, he was. Famously was an atheist for a long time, but then during his time at Oxford with friends like Tolkien, who wrote Lord of the Rings, famous for that, and a bunch of others, he very, very slowly and somewhat reluctantly was converted from atheism to theism and then finally to Christianity. And then he became this great apologist for Christianity. And he was also responsible for a whole lot of fantasies as well. He's, as you mentioned earlier, the writer of the Narnia series that for over 50 years now have been loved all over the world by kids and adults.
Yeah, so we're talking books like The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, Prince Caspian, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and all of these have been, or most of them, actually those ones have been made into really popular movies in recent times. So these stories, they still resonate today. They still have an audience. But, you know, could you say that they're also fantasies, so not that different in some ways from the Kennedy Camelot kind of fantasy?
Yeah, well, some will say so, but it's well known that C.S. Lewis was this great defender of Christian faith, having become a believer. He wrote the Narnia series as a kind of imaginative recreation of the Christian story. He wanted it just to be a good story, and I think he succeeded in that. But certainly this was meant to reflect something of his experience of the Christian faith. So these were, he said, he described it like this. He said, I want to just get past the kind of stained glass Sunday school feeling about what Christianity is about and give it real potency for the kids and adults who read it.
It was the unicorn who summed up what everyone was feeling. He stamped his right forehoof on the ground and neighed and then cried, I have come home at last. This is my real country. I belong here. This is the land I have been looking for all my life, though I never knew it till now. The reason why we loved the old Narnia is that it sometimes looked a little like this. Come further up. Come further in.
There's also this idea in Lewis that, you know, his fantasy stories weren't actually told to deceive in that sense of a myth that is designed to pull the wool over your eyes, but they actually were to represent what was really real in a way, and in a way that was actually revealing the way that the world was.
It's true that Lewis said he was not just using imagination for invention, but in creating these worlds, he was writing about what he described as the divine, magical, terrifying, and ecstatic reality of the world we actually live in. He said he wanted kids to be confronted with the fact that they do live in a world of death and violence and wounds and adventure and good and evil and heroism, or at least the opportunity for that. And so he was also talking about what he described as the reality behind the reality. He said it was an even more substantial reality of God being there and being found in the figure of Jesus, represented here as Aslan. This is about what he said was the really real fantasy stories to illustrate reality. And in his mind, this was a profound, frightening, but really wonderfully exciting reality.
He shook his mane and sprang forward into a great gallop, a unicorn's gallop, which, in our world, would have carried him out of sight in a few moments. But now a most strange thing happened. Everyone else began to run, and they found, to their astonishment, that they could keep up with him. Not only the dogs and the humans, but even fat little Puzzle and short-legged Poggin, the dwarf. The air flew in their faces as if they were driving fast in a car without a windscreen. The country flew past as if they were seeing it from the windows of an express train. Faster and faster they raced, but no one got hot or tired or out of breath.